Bigfoot, Nessie, Chupacabra. Are these and other purported monsters the real deal? Or are they really not more than a fantasy of those who want to believe? We'll ask those questions on The Cryptid Report. Welcome to The Cryptid Report. I am Jim Harold, and so glad to be with you once again. And I think you're really going to enjoy this show today because we're going to get the perspective of a scientist on the topic of hunting monsters. I'm talking about Dr. Darren Naish. He is calling in on Skype over from the UK, and we're so glad to have him with us. He is a paleontologist and founder of the weblog Tetrapod Zoology. He is the author or co-author of a number of books on prehistoric animals, such as the Encyclopedia of Dinosaurs and Prehistoric Life, and The Evidence, which was published to accompany the BBC TV series Walking with Dinosaurs. And we're so glad to have him with us today. The new book he has out is Hunting Monsters. Dr. Naish, welcome today.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on.
I'm fascinated because you have a very academic background, and when people think about cryptozoology and maybe things like Bigfoot and Sasquatch and those kind of things, there's almost, and I don't mean this in a negative way, but an amateur cast to it. There are a lot of amateur hunters out there who are seeking these different kind of creatures, whether folks believe it, believe it or not. I mean, as a scientist, what got you interested in this field?
Yeah, you're right. I have always been interested in cryptozoology, in the study of monsters. I've always seen it as part of my broader interest in animals in general. And to someone with paleontological interests, many of the claims made by cryptozoologists are of special relevance because they say that we've made some major mistakes, that we've missed some major groups of animals. It's not difficult as a trained scientist to go and look at the evidence that we have, which is of varying quality, and come to various conclusions. So it's something that anyone with a scientific bent certainly has justification for being finding interest in it. I'm not ashamed about the fact that I'm interested in it, and have tried to actually apply proper science, get proper technical publications out of research on this subject. Because a thing I always say to people, no matter where they are on the spectrum in terms of from a true believer to an absolute naysayer, mm-hmm. is it doesn't matter what your take is, whether there are real animals to find here or not, there still is science you can do here, because we are still dealing with a body of data. At the very least, we're dealing with a large number of anecdotes and stories and encounters, and that's still stuff that we can subject to scientific testing. So I kind of think, more scientists should get involved in this field, to be honest. It's fascinating.
Now, cryptozoology is very, very broad. We talk about animals of the sea, or maybe species in the sea we haven't discovered yet. You're talking about land animals, ostensibly. I think kind of my thinking is, and I cover a wide range of unusual phenomena on my different programs, but when it comes to cryptozoology, I don't consider myself per se a believer in Bigfoot or Sasquatch. But on the other hand, the world, to put it in a very layperson's text, it's a very big place. And for example, on the seafloor, we're always discovering new species that we had no idea existed. So is there something inherently wrong with thinking, hey, there may be creatures out there that are very elusive? Maybe they go to some kind of lengths, when you talk about Bigfoot or Sasquatch, go to some lengths to cover their tracks, as it were. Is it unreasonable to think that there actually might be some very strange animals out there?
It's not unreasonable. You're absolutely right. One of the things that I hope everybody interested in this can grasp right from the start is that anybody who's familiar with the history of zoological discovery, the history of discoveries of animals on land or in the seas or even in large freshwater bodies, we've still got good reason to think that there are new large animal species to find. We can confirm this from the fact that we have been naming new species within recent years. So most people are familiar with relatively large animals, famously things like the okapi, the Komodo dragon, the mountain gorilla, all named in the early 1900s. We've got large animals that have been named within my lifetime, you know, since the 1970s, new species of large sharks and large whales, and a few species of, say, deer-sized, antelope-sized, you know, new mammals on land. So everybody, every zoologist, every technically trained zoologist would agree that, yes, there almost certainly are at least a few new animals to find. There are various ways of working out how many there might be. People have done, there's various statistical techniques you can do when you look at discovery rates plotted over time. You can work out how many more there might still be out there. And all of these studies say that there's probably a few. There's not lots. There certainly aren't as many as cryptozoologists have actually proposed. There are at least a few. So in principle, yes, in principle, we think it's quite plausible there are new species to find. The next issue, though, is whether those animals, those unknown animals, whether they actually match the kind of creatures that cryptozoology in particular is interested in. That's kind of a different, more nuanced, more complex issue. The short answer, I think, and I explain this in the book, is the creatures that cryptozoologists specifically search for, unfortunately, are all the least likely to exist, sadly. It doesn't seem that there's great evidence that does support their existence. But, you know, it's not a ridiculous concept. And for that reason, I think it's good practice to keep an open mind, not I like that phrase. It's good to keep an open mind, but not so open that your brain.
I say that all the time. I say that all the time. And that's not so open your brains fall out. I say that all the time on the programs. Now, right. One of the areas where I am a total layperson to this. This is not even my number one area of interest in the strange and the Freudian and the unusual. However, to me, when you talk about in the book, you talk about monsters of the deep. Here's where it seems much more plausible that there are things we don't understand. And I go back to this kind of thing. And again, I know that eyewitnesses are sometimes the most unreliable sources for information. But when you look at monsters of the deep and you look at news reports from the 1800s and the early 1900s, and obviously these people did not have access to, the DVDs of the X-Files. So it's not a case of popular culture necessarily creating these things. Whether it's current reports or past reports, Monsters of the Deep seems like a fairly plausible one to me. What did you talk about in the book in regard to those Monsters of the Deep?
Yes, so we've got, you know, going back thousands of years, you've got hundreds of cases of people observing creatures that they can't understand, and which until very recently were describing, you know, giant things that couldn't be interpreted as belonging to any known species. Now, it's the further back you go in time, the harder it becomes to identify sea monsters as described in eyewitness encounters and as illustrated on maps and so on. It becomes harder to identify them with known species. And I think that's because you go back a few hundred years, go back to the 1500s and let alone beyond that, people are not describing animals that really are real. They often did have concepts of sea monsters, and they had these concepts for various different reasons. Because it was useful to endorse the idea of a certain mythological creature. For example, an idea quite widespread in the ancient world was that there were marine partners to all land living animals. So if you knew of a horse, well, then there had to be a seahorse. And I don't mean a small fish. I mean, you know, literally a horse with flippers and fins and such. So people had those kind of ideas because that's how they were, you know, forming their view of the world. They thought there must be these things. We know that during the Middle Ages, some people, when they were illustrating maps, deliberately put spectacular monsters on them for economic reasons, because they actually were using the monsters to show which areas were dangerous, which areas are, you know, treacherous. And also, there's some data that historians have uncovered, which shows how Scandinavian fishers were using monsters on maps to scare people from other countries away from the shorelines. Don't go here because it's really dangerous. So you've got these spectacular creatures that weren't necessarily based on real things. As you come closer to the modern age, you have got people describing creatures that initially don't seem to match anything we know. But the more we learn about the appearance of various sea creatures in life, and the more we learn about how exactly they behave and so on, it is sometimes proven possible to work out what they are, something that wasn't possible prior to aerial photography or underwater photography. I mean, I'm sure you can understand that until the 20th century, people didn't have good whole body shots of Rorqual whales, so blue whale, fin whale, sei whale. They knew what they looked like from washed up, you know, dead ones and from animals they'd killed, but they didn't know exactly what these animals looked like when they were alive, because they never saw the whole thing and you never saw it above the surface. Some sea monster sightings, you look at them now, you can work out they are confused. Sometimes at some distance, they're confused observations of known animal species. And sometimes just the bits of those animals. I mean, if you saw like a whale or a large sea lion or something doing an unusual thing with one part of its body, just a fin or just a tail or something, then you look at some of these old sea monster reports. They are descriptions of, they're confused descriptions of animals when people didn't have as much information as we do now.
So in other words, they weren't hoaxes per se, or at least a number of them weren't hoaxes. They were misinterpretations of animals we know today, but they didn't know back then.
I think, yes, absolutely. I think that explains not all of them, but a lot of them. There's a whole bunch that we can't explain at all, and it might be that we'll never be able to explain them. There are a whole bunch that there's good reasons for thinking they are hoaxes or tall tales. But yes, there's others that are misinterpretations, honest mistakes. And for I became academically interested in sea monster accounts in particular because there were two, both from the Atlantic, that I always thought were fantastic. I thought they can't be explained as anything. They don't match anything. One is the Daedalus encounter from off the coast of Namibia in southern Africa. One is the Valhalla incident from off the coast of Brazil. These two encounters initially seem to describe animals that you can't match with anything. But in recent years, the more we've learned, we have discovered that, in fact, those two cases, the classic sea monster accounts, can probably be explained as confused sightings of known species.
Now, if we talk about monsters and we talk about bodies of water, no discussion of that subject can be complete without talking about the Loch Ness Monster. I mean, do you think there's anything to Nessie, or do you think that it's so many hoaxes and misinterpretations, people seeing what they want to see? What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's hard for me to come up with, as I like to regard myself as an honest skeptic, certainly not a debunker. I think it's difficult to give a hard line answer on an issue like that. Is there a Loch Ness Monster? Well, the short answer is no, in the sense that I don't think there's a new species of large undiscovered animal. There's no reptile from prehistory. There's no weird unknown species of freshwater whale or long-necked seal or giant salamander or any of the other things that monster aficionados have proposed. No, there isn't an animal like that. But there is still, in quotes, a Loch Ness Monster, because there's a concept. There's people go to Loch Ness, they look across the waters and they see things, and they see a large, you know, there's a long list of things you can see. And people expect to see a monster. I think that they see any one of these things. When I say things, I'm talking about the possibility of unusual water birds, which most people aren't. Most people don't know animals like grebes and loons, swimming deer, seals, particularly big fish, unusual wave and wake effects, and all these things, floating wood and such. And they see those things and they automatically interpret them as a monster. So, yeah, there is kind of a monster. There's a monster concept that people have in mind. And a thing that I try and get across in the book is I don't think that, sadly, I don't think that there really are, you know, there is no Nessie. There is no new species to find there, sadly. But it's still fascinating that there is the concept of the monster. There's the idea deeply ingrained in our culture that you can go to a place and see a monster. And that, of course, doesn't just apply to Loch Ness. It applies to many of these so-called monsters, yeah.
And when we talk about cryptozoology, there is the Big Mac Daddy, as we say, the one that everybody wonders about, and that is Bigfoot. And when I think about Bigfoot, the first thing when I became aware of it as a as a kid, and I'm just probably a few years older than you, is the Patterson-Gimlin film. Mm. And that famous footage. And, you know, I know people have done enhancements and they've slowed it down and they sped it up. Is it real? Is it not real? And it seems to be the you know, how every religion has kind of its holy relic. That seems to be the holy relic of Bigfoot and Sasquatch studies. What do you think about the Patterson film?
Where do I start? I mean, whole books could be written about the Patterson film, and literally they have been. So, for years, I was quite impressed by many of the anatomical details that have been described, written about by the likes of Grover Krantz and Jeff Meldrum, most recently, of course, by Bill Munns in his book. And, did broadly agree with them that some of the details that you see, are difficult to explain with the human gait. Having said that, having now learned the specifics of how you can move and mimic them, cut a very long story short, I don't think that any of the claims about the biological reality of Patty, in quotes, the creature in the footage, none of them stand up. They can all be faked by, they can all be made by a person. They're all within the range of the human gait, and the claims about the size and the mass of the creature, that it exceeds the breadth and the height of people as well, they're erroneous. They all depend on tiny differences in terms of how close the object is to the camera. Of course, the footage itself, the original film, is it's tiny. It's the object on the film is tiny. The idea that you can zoom in and get all this extraordinary number of details from a piece of film that small is really dubious. And plus, we didn't have so much information on Roger Patterson himself as we do now. Now, you probably know, among Bigfoot aficionados, the name Greg Long is, there are people that like the book he did, The Making of Bigfoot, The Inside Story. There are mm-hmm. people that like that book, mm-hmm. and there are people who would like all of them put in a big pile and burnt. And I don't enjoy the book. I think it's incredibly badly written and very annoying. But the main point is, he gathered this incredible amount of circumstantial sort of background data to Patterson, which you do have to take into account. And what I take from it is that Patterson was no bumbling redneck who went into the woods and just struck it lucky one day. This guy was a genius with his hands and a great mind, and he was clearly, you know, he'd spent decades making things and scheming and coming up with ideas, and he was a brilliant artist. And I find it quite compelling, the idea that he was up to this. He was up to creating a hoax of this magnitude, of this brilliance. And so I so wish the Patterson footage was real. I've really come to the conclusion that it isn't. I think the background on Patterson helps, and it does explain several of the details that you do see in the footage. So, and even among diehard Bigfoot believers, you do have, I'm sure you've heard from them, you have at least a group of people who say that we're never going to agree on the Patterson footage anyway. So it's never going to be, it's not unambiguous, even if you're as sympathetic to it as you can be. They say, you know, look at all the other evidence we've got, and all the other evidence that we do have at the moment. Again, sadly, we've got lots of things that are suggestive, but we just don't have anything that's compelling, as it really should be at this point. By this time, we should have something that's withstood scrutiny, and we don't have anything. We have lots of things that, they might convince you if you're a member of Matt Moneymaker's organization or something, or if you enjoy watching, what's that TV show? Hunting Bigfoot.
Well, there's Finding Bigfoot. There's Killing Bigfoot. There's a lot of different programs out there. Well, let me ask you this, because this is where it becomes difficult for me a little bit, in the sense, there are hundreds, if not thousands, I would say probably thousands of reports, and certainly anecdotal reports and eyewitness sightings. And I do believe that a percentage of them are obviously fake. Hoaxes. People think I'm going to get my 15 minutes of fame, whatever the case may be. So let's just assume, because I think it's a pretty safe assumption, that a decent amount of reports are just that. But what about reliable people, people respected in their community, people who are not necessarily, quote, Bigfoot hunters, who have seen this strange biped creature? Can we just reject all of those out of hand? Because that's where it becomes difficult for me, because I believe they're people of goodwill. And there are people who are, you know, otherwise, you know, totally sane, upstanding citizens, and they've reported that they've seen something. Should we just discount their reports?
Well, I'm in the same, I'm in the same intellectual position as you. I don't believe we should just dismiss them. But whether what they describe is, again, compelling enough for us to be confident is the big question. So, yes, I do think there's some fraction, some percentage of people who claim to have encounters that really have seen something that is difficult to explain. They're not hoaxes. They really have seen something. So is it now at the risk of saying the same thing that every skeptic has ever said before? I'll try not to be too predictable, but we do have this extensive literature, these thousands of studies, literally thousands of studies, which do basically show that people are pretty terrible eyewitnesses. People are terrible at remembering what they've seen. They're also terrible at later relating what they've seen and, you know, recalling the details of what they've seen. What you think you have seen is not the same as what you actually perceived. So there is this ambiguity about eyewitness evidence of all kinds. When it comes to human-shaped creatures in particular, now, of course, we're all familiar with Bigfoot or Sasquatch, and we all associate it with the continental United States and Canada. But man-shaped or human-shaped creatures are not unique to North America. They're seen everywhere, literally everywhere. Literally everywhere. The subantarctic islands, Australia, New Zealand, Fiji, Hawaii. Here in the UK, within recent years, we've had a spate of people claiming to see Bigfoot in England, Scotland, and Wales, which is, you can just about buy the possibility that a large undiscovered primate could hide out in Alaska or Saskatchewan, no problem. Possibly even, you know, any big foresty place in North America, just about buy that. But for the UK, where we eliminated any animal larger than a house brick within the past couple of centuries, nah, there's just a non-starter. I think that we know, again, we know this for a fact, humans are programmed to look for other humans. We see the human shape in everything. It's called pareidolia. You know, we have this tendency, sure, to look for patterns. We see human faces everywhere, and people have looked at, you know, random static and stuff, and they see faces.
Clouds.
And we see the
clouds.
Clouds, yes. We see the human body shape, the human profile, particularly in semi-darkness. And, of course, we're inclined to, you know, have interesting experiences when we're slightly afraid, when we're in places that we should be afraid of, you know, dark forests and such, mountainous places. So I think that's a big part of the picture. I think the fact that people look for human shapes and human faces explains why human-shaped creatures are so ubiquitous, so common, why people see them so often. Then you also combine that with the fact that people do honestly see other animals and mistake them for hairy, dark, human-shaped things. So we know without doubt. I mean, I don't want to say that every Bigfoot sighting can be explained as a bear. I certainly don't think that's true. But at least some encounters with bears do explain some of these encounters. Some encounters with large deer. There are quite a few sightings, some of which have involved, you know, photographs that have been checked afterwards, where people have seen bipeds standing at the roadside, and they're actually seeing deer, any one of the species, but particularly the moose because it's the biggest one. You see them from the front or from behind. You don't really appreciate you're seeing a four-legged animal because you just see it foreshortened. You just see the two legs. Plus, of course, people see other people and mistake them for wild creatures, Sasquatch or Bigfoot type creatures. We even know that in some of the places where people say they see Bigfoot type creatures, there are supposed to be like people living wild, like, you know, feral people, tramps, whatever. That I think you've got several explanations that can explain some of this stuff. They don't explain all of it. Now, I wouldn't say to someone who has described a close-up encounter with a creature that couldn't be dismissed as a human or a bear or a moose or a pareidolia or a shadow, I wouldn't say to their face that, you know, you're lying or you were hallucinating or something. I don't know what the best explanation is in those cases. So there still is, you know, it's not like everything can be chucked out for now and there's no potential mystery to explore. There is still something interesting there, but the big problem remains. Why don't we have that evidence? And we really should have by now.
Now, one of the big objections to the objective reality of a Bigfoot type species is the idea we've never found a body. Now, I've presented that to several people who are, quote, Bigfoot hunters, cryptozoologists and the like. And they say, well, you know, I've been a hunter for X amount of years and you very rarely find the carcass of a dead animal that they're dragged off by the other members or carrion, you know. Decimate it and eat it over. Is that a fair response to that question, or is that kind of a, for lack of a better term, a cop out?
Yeah, it is a cop out. I mean, it's quite common in the Bigfoot literature for you to hear this. I think it was Grover Krantz in his book. He said that every single bear bone or bit of a dead bear has never been picked up in the wild. He said every single specimen has come from an animal that someone has shot. And that's still quite a prevalent idea in the Bigfoot community. It is absolutely false. It's absolutely incorrect. You can find remains of you have to be lucky, and yes, they are rare. Not saying they're common. Yes, they are rare, but they are out there. People have found them, and people have found the remains of all of the, if we're just, again, just talking about North America, you know, every single animal that's documented as a real thing has been discovered in a deceased state, or its bones are known, or it's known from the zooarchaeological or paleontological record. There is, at the moment, there is not one piece of evidence that, you know, bone or fur or whatever from the fossil record or the zooarchaeological record. That's kind of like stuff that's not fossil, but it's not archaeology because it doesn't involve humans. There's nothing. And there really should be something if something were there. And again, you get this common thing that people say they find bones and isn't there the possibility they look like they were bigger than the bones of humans, or could they be a, because we've also got this idea, it's complicating matters increasingly nowadays. You've got this idea that Sasquatch Bigfoot is actually a particular, you know, subset of our species, that Bigfoot is a kind of human. People are saying, well, people find, you know, they find human bones, and there's obviously an enormous number of human archaeological remains. Couldn't some of those be Bigfoot? And again, it's, well, virtually all of these remains have been tested or are tested as a matter of, you know, law and murder investigations and whatnot. And if there was a specific group, or if there was a specific subset of our species that we could call like the Bigfoot section of Homo sapiens, then you would be able to identify it as such through anatomical criteria or through genetics. And that has not been done. And So far, all the results are contrary to that. There was, of course, this famous case from a couple of years back now, Melba Ketchum and colleagues claiming that they said they had DNA evidence for the validity of Sasquatch being a section of Homo sapiens. But no, I know quite a lot about that study. For various complex reasons, it has been looked into in depth by a large number of other qualified geneticists, other labs, and they did not report any, they didn't back up any of the conclusions that the Ketchum team did. And someone else would have found the same result if there was validity to those claims. And I'm afraid, no, they were erroneous.
So people who believe that these creatures exist, whether we're talking about a Bigfoot or a Loch Ness monster or other ones that we've not covered today, they might have two comebacks, and I want to get your opinion on each of them. So forgive me, but this is the voice of the believer speaking. The believer might say, well, there are two things going on here, whether not specifically you, but just with, quote, skeptics in general. A, either like believers, believers have a blind spot, obviously, but skeptics have a blind spot as well, and they're just not looking at the evidence. That's objection one, and that's actually the gentler one. And then number two is the idea that for whatever reason, there's actually a cover-up going on among scientists in regard to these types of creatures. For whatever reason, it doesn't map to, you know, standard belief, and people are very protective of their research. And if something contradicts it, they may not want to bring it in because of career and so forth. To the believer who would say those, one of those two things, what would you say in each case?
I've heard, of course, both these ideas. They're both really interesting. And where do they take us? Well, looking at evidence, do skeptics have a kind of blind spot? I don't know how appreciated it is, but even most people who call themselves skeptics kind of, I don't want to say want to be wrong, but would like to be wrong. So I would like nothing more than for Sasquatch or the Loch Ness Monster to be real. And I'm not the only one who became interested in this subject because I initially thought that it was looking likely that these animals were real. I wanted them to be real. And I wrote a technical article on Sasquatch around about 2006, which I was going to get published, which was basically saying that I think the evidence for it is pretty compelling. At the time, I was heavily influenced by Jeff Meldrum's work on alleged stuff about the shape of the foot and the gait, including in the Patterson footage and various other lines of evidence, and the Skookum body cast as well, notorious case. And, you know, having learned a lot more and maybe matured a little bit intellectually, maybe, I've come to think that no, the evidence does not support. So I don't agree there is a blind spot. No, I think we're well aware of the quality of the evidence and would like to be wrong, but one, you know, bring on evidence that shows us to be wrong. And that isn't happening. It hasn't happened yet. So don't stop trying, but it hasn't happened yet. Is there a cover up, or could there be anything like a cover up? Science, again, this sounds kind of a bit cliched, please forgive me, but science is quite a cutthroat business. It's not like one happy band of people that are all moving in the same direction and shaking hands all the time and agreeing with one another. It's a lot of, combat, people screwing each other over to get positions, to get jobs, to publish results first, to publish results that trash or discolor the favored conclusions of your colleagues. They might even be your friends, but you say, "Haha, I've shown you wrong because my science is better than yours." That is all over the place. Nothing would make you a famous scientist, potentially with the possibility to get a tenure track job and, you know, the sort of things that scientists want for financial stability and funding for their lab and their research and stuff. Nothing would be better than to do something as bold as demonstrate the existence of Yeti or Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster. So there isn't a friendly community of people moving in the same direction. And there is this inherent competitivity where people are trying to outdo other groups. That is just totally against the idea that there can be a cover-up. I mean, I'm an independent researcher, and I'm not working for big science or anything. You know, there's no way I can not go into a museum and find something that stuff isn't concealed in museums. If you're a technical researcher, you can get in there and see what they've got, even if you're not supposed to. So basically this all works against the idea of a cover-up. I just, yeah, it's not something to take seriously, but it's a fun idea.
Well, another fun idea, and this is one that I'm personally, I'm much more willing to accept the possibility that there might be species out there wandering around that we haven't discovered. Now, this is one that I personally is not a favorite of mine, but it's been put out there, and I think it's beyond the scope of your work, but I just want to get your opinion on it. What if these creatures, hold on to your hats, have a supernatural aspect, and they're multi-dimensional travelers. That's why we've never found a body or anything like this. Have you ever, I'm sure you've heard this theory. Do you have, even if it's beyond the scope of your research, do you have any thoughts on it?
I'm familiar with it. I mean, because it's one of the, once people start to have problems with the idea of, say, cryptids, mystery animals as in quotes, flesh and blood creatures, they do tend to resort to these paranormal explanations. But to start with, and this whole book's devoted to this, there's a famous book, Janet and Colin Board, Alien Animals, where they propose that all of the famous classes of monsters are all interdimensional creatures or time travelers that pass through portals or whatever. It's not a scientific idea. It's That's not to say that it's not an idea that we can test with science, because at the moment, the very concepts there are not something that's consistent with our understanding of how the universe works. And with all due respect to the people who've come up with these ideas, none of them are people that understand how the universe works either. In fact, quite frequently, they are the very opposite of that. They're people that come up with stuff and, yeah, I don't want to be mean, but you know, we're not talking about nuclear physicists or astronomers here. We're talking about people who just make stuff up and don't really know what the terms mean. So if you're talking about things shifting in and out of other dimensions or portals, explain how that fits within our understanding of the universe. I'm not going to do that because I'm not, obviously, as you say, I'm not an expert in those areas. So I don't think that's a scientifically viable idea. But from the kind of more first principles concept is why would we need to go down that route anyway? It's, I think, the only reason that people come up with those kinds of explanations is a desperate case of special pleading, where it's an attempted answer to the question, why haven't we found the body of Loch Ness Monster? Why haven't we got DNA or bones or bodies of Bigfoot? Well, because it's a phantom, because it's from another dimension, because it's a shape-shifting android or something. It's like you've totally shifted the goalpost because you can't find the evidence that you should according to everything we understand. And all of the eyewitness encounters that we've been talking about, the idea that these creatures do fit into an ecology and natural history, they're part of the evolutionary scheme of the way things are in general, all those ideas basically build them up to be kind of, you know, real creatures. So why would you have to go beyond that? It just seems to be a case of special pleading when we're lacking the evidence.
It's been a great conversation. I've really enjoyed it. And the thing that I love is, you know, we've talked to various skeptics on various programs, and sometimes it's like, there's nothing to any of this, and let's not even talk about it. Why am I talking to you? Whereas this has been very reasoned and thoughtful, and I appreciate your time today, Dr. Darren Naish. Where can people find the book Hunting Monsters, Cryptozoology, and the Reality Behind the Myths?
Oh, it's widely available on any of your favorite digital retailers. It's still available as an ebook. It's also now in shops as a proper hard copy book. I have a few other books that are available on Amazon and such as well. And I've got a couple of books that are available through an online company called irregularbooks.co, one of which, again, is cryptozoology themed. And best way to follow what I'm doing and book projects in the works is to follow me on Twitter at Tet Zoo, T-E-T Zoo. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And thank you for listening to the Cryptid Report. And you heard Dr. Naish. If you have the evidence, bring it forth. Because who knows, there are many things in the universe and many things we do not understand. Maybe you'll be the one that will find the smoking gun. We thank you for joining us today on the Cryptid Report. Have a great week, everybody. Bye.